The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's Tuesday, August 27th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Why do I sound so energetic? I'll tell you why. I'm on vacation. And I am bringing you this brand new interview via a recording technology. We have traversed through time and space to bring you this interview, even though no one's in the studio today. On the program, investigative journalist Todd Miller's Empire of Borders, how the U.S. is exporting its border around the world. It's a fascinating look at the concept of a border and how we project it outward. Also on the program, for members, you're going to get a deep archive pick from Brendan. That means something from the show, the first iteration of the Majority Report on Air America back with Janine and I. I don't know. Maybe I'm not even included in some of these picks. He says they're very entertainment-oriented, so a little light break from politics. So if you're a member, check that out. Stay tuned. It'll come up after the interview. If you're not a member, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Freeloading, I think, is the answer.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't say that, but I'm thinking it. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. You'll support the free show. You'll get extra content. You will love it. Meanwhile, I know you're desperate for some update on the daily news. Well, then you should be subscribed to our Majority Report feed on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever you get your podcast feeds, and listen to the AM Quickie. We're doing a five-minute news brief every day. It's either hosted by myself or Lucy Steiner, who I know you will love, and every morning we do it, even when we're on vacation. Even when I'm on vacation. What kind of idiot does that? Idiot. Stupid. Well, that's what it is, folks. Can't help it. Trying to launch a new show. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Empire of Borders with Todd Miller, the expansion of the U.S. border around the world. Be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Todd Miller. He is the author of Empire of Borders, the expansion of the U.S. border around the world. He is a winner of the 2018 Izzy Award for investigative journalism. You may have seen his writing in the New York Times, Mother Jones, The Nation, Al Jazeera, English, Salon, Tom Dispatch. Todd, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So there's two sort of almost fundamental questions that I want to ask you. I'm trying to figure out which one is the better one to ask first. But well, let's do it this way. What do we mean when we talk about, because you write about essentially border imperialism. What do we mean by border in this context, and how has the concept of the border changed?
Yeah, that's a big, maybe somewhat complicated question, but I'll try to answer as best as I can. One of the things that happened, especially post 9/11, was a shift of the the strategizing of Customs and Border Protection and Department of, and then with the formation of the Department of Homeland Security. And if you go to one of the strategists, Alan Burson, he was a border czar under the Clinton administration. He was also worked for DHS under the Obama administration. He called it, he said, we started looking less at lines, or both at lines, I want to stress, and then flows of people. In other words, as many CBP commissioners have put it since then, and it's also in the strategy papers, the border no longer is the first nor last line of defense, meaning that the border, the actual U.S., when you think of the border, if you think of the U.S.-Mexico border, that is only one layer, a prominent layer of what the border is. But the border actually ripples out internationally, and also there's an interior portion of it. And that's when you begin to grapple the question of what the border is, that's one way to look at it. And I could give you some concrete examples of what that actually looks like if you'd like.
Yeah, do. And I wonder, well, why don't you give us those concrete examples, and then we'll talk about how much this was theory, like how much of a philosophical change does it represent, or simply, I mean, I am reminded of that era in the wake of 9/11, where the cry was fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. On some level, it sort of feels like it's that same theory which was being employed.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It is coming from that same basic theory. If you look at the 9/11 Commission report that came out, I believe it was in 2003, one of the things that it says is that the quote-unquote the American homeland is the planet. So the idea of bringing the border out away, pushing it out away from the United States to stop people or items or weapons of mass destruction, if you will, from coming to the United States long before they even get close to our borders. That's the official justification when you look at this kind of shift over to this internationalization. And I remember, oh, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, like, was there a change? I mean, obviously we have a long history in this country of vilifying at different times immigrants and exploiting them. Also, I mean, obviously, in many ways, structurally, we were set up to welcome them. Was there a fundamental change in the sort of philosophical perspective of immigrants that needed to take place? I mean, just as I say, like fight them over there as opposed to over here. Well, they're immigrants. They're not terrorists. They're not an invading army. They're potential immigrants. I mean, was there a concurrent change in the philosophical perspective of immigrants?
Yeah, I would say that's correct, especially when you look at the post 9/11 shifts, and actually one person called it a massive paradigm shift as far as CBP is concerned. But in that comes this viewing of immigrants through the lens of the of the post 9/11 reality. For example, when CBP or Customs and Border Protection didn't even exist when 2001 in September 11, 2001, it was formed after that, and when it was formed, its priority mission was stopping terrorists, quote-unquote terrorists and weapons of mass destruction from crossing U.S. borders. So you have the setup of the CBP. If you look at the budgets going out of 2011 to present, the budget started increasing in historic ways, unprecedented ways, and the justification was a terrorism justification. And so you get all these budgets coming in, you have all these resources going into to building up a border apparatus, a border and immigration apparatus. Mind you, ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was created also in 2003. So all these resources going into this, under a counter-terror justification, but yet, as you say, what we have, what these sorts of new this apparatus is impacting, who this apparatus is impacting, are in fact mostly immigrants coming from particularly Latin America, the Americas, but even all around the world, but under a kind of terrorism justification. So if, like, following border policy in the 2000s, for example, you see this kind of what is coming, you know, are there terrorists coming across the border? You know, all this sort of rhetoric of terrorism, that sort of thing, the budget's going up, but yet there's not one incident ever of a person, at least that we know about, of a person that's affiliated with a terrorist organization as known by the U.S. government from crossing the U.S. border. And so you have this buildup under the certain post 9/11 rubric, but it's mainly the arsenal is aimed at the immigrant. And so the immigrant, so basically, you know, you have the kind of anti-immigrant sentiment that's kind of behind the veil of that.
It's interesting because it ostensibly, right, it's like a hidden threat that exists in this group of people that we weren't aware of before that ultimately doesn't exist. And the fallout from creating that threat almost supersedes now the original proposition that existed in that regard. And we should say the southern border, right? You're talking about the southern border. I mean, I remember there was the millennium bombing, millennial, or I think that's what, I can't remember, coming. It came in through Canada, or there was an attempt like in Seattle or somewhere around there, I think. Up in that was, I can't remember exactly the details, but.
That is correct. That's 1999. So it was pre-DHS.
Right.
And that's the one incident that is brought up if you about a terrorist coming across the U.S. border, the Millennium bomber. And I, go ahead.
Okay. Well, no, and that was right, and that was done prior to the apparatus that we have now. Okay, so you were going to mention some. So we have this situation now where we have projected the border and really, in some ways, sort of vaporized it as a geographic distinction. And almost created like some form of, I guess, repellent or just sort of like a force field that we project out based upon where we see flows of people coming. Can you give us like some of those tangible examples you were talking about?
Yeah, sure. One example, and this might have been, I worked on the story that really prompted me to look into writing this book. It happened in 2010 when the big earthquake hit Haiti. And I did an article for NACLA on what was happening as far as immigration was concerned. And what I found out almost immediately was that the United States sent 16 Coast Guard cutters, basically ships, right up to the Haitian shores, and they also sent a supply plane over Haiti, which was flying low and with the voice of the ambassador of Haiti to the United States. He was talking in Creole, asking people not to leave the country, not to leave Haiti. And mind you, there's over 300,000 people who were killed in that earthquake. Over a million people displaced. And so this idea of the border kind of expanding, the elastic border going right up to the shores of Haiti, was actually quite surprising to me. And I've been studying, you know, borders, particularly the U.S.-Mexico border, for quite a while. And so that was a prominent example how quickly a border could be, it's not in a static position, it could be mobilized to move. And also to add, there was detention beds set up in Guantanamo Bay by the company Geo Group that was anticipating this displacement upheaval and then migration of Haitians. So that's one example. And then after that, I did go to Puerto Rico, maybe 2 years later in 2012. And of course, Puerto Rico is U.S. territory. I was studying the Border Patrol in Puerto Rico, which is, again, it's 1,000 miles from the mainland. And I was surprised to see on the west coast of Puerto Rico all the green striped vehicles that I normally see where I live in Arizona. I live in Tucson, Arizona. And I was, wow, you know, I knew that there was Border Patrol there, but I didn't realize how extensive the patrolling of the west coast of Puerto Rico. And mind you, the west coast is looking out onto the Mona Strait. And across the Mona Strait is the Dominican Republic. So I find out later that the Border Patrol can go as far as the Mona Island, which is about 32 miles from the Dominican Republic, and literally be you know, pretty much patrolling the coast of the Dominican Republic, almost as close to San Diego as to Tijuana.
Okay, so I have two questions regarding that. The first is the sovereignty question. Like, how, what allows a foreign government, in this case the United States government, to enter into Haiti airspace, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I don't, maybe there's no provisions for this at all. And basically announce to the Haitian people, like, stay here. What allows for in international, I mean, maybe they're in international waters when we send all these cutters there to presumably intercept refugees at that basis. I guess if we're in international waters, we're in international waters, but certainly flying over the country and saying, you know, stay where you are. How do, I mean, can countries just do that? Can Canada send military planes over the United States and just start announcing, like, hey, we want you guys to, I don't know, buy more maple syrup or something? I mean, like, what's involved in terms of, do we have a treaties for this? How do we get away with that?
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see Canadian, you know, if the Canadian Air Force sort of sent their planes over the United States. I bet, can you imagine what kind of media coverage that would get?
Yeah, and, I mean, that seems like it'd be sort of problematic. I mean, do we have permission from the Haiti government, the Haitian government, to cross the country and say, stay where you are? I mean, that's, that seems problematic to me.
I do believe you're correct. The plane was a supply plane, so technically it was part of the United States aid mission to Haiti post earthquake. So, but obviously it was being used as for another reason, a quote unquote homeland security reason. And I believe the Coast Guard cutters were able to get they're allowed to patrol, quote unquote, allowed to patrol in international waters. So I believe they were able to get up right up into where the technical international boundary is coming off the Haitian coast, which I think it's about 10 miles. So they were kind of prowling around the Haitian coast in the international waters, expecting people to leave. And then, quite frankly, you know, like, as your Canadian example, the Canada example really underscores, I mean, what other country could possibly do that? I mean, you know, there's a certain kind of bravado or, I guess, aggressiveness in policy that the United States, you know, has shown over many, many years and continues to show, like, that the United States has long considered Latin America, the Americas, the Caribbean to be its quote unquote backyard, that it can do, you know, pretty much whatever it pleases in those places. And this seems to be another example of that. So the kind of border extension you see is an example of that.
I mean, at one point, right, that has to infringe upon sovereignty unless we have some type of, I guess, treaty or something to that effect. And maybe that there's examples of that in other places. Let me ask you this, that when there's a situation like the Haitian earthquake, and we had, I'm not sure how many tens of thousands of Haitians that we allowed into the country under a temporary protected status, program, that I don't know how many of those people now have been sent back to Haiti under the Trump administration. I would imagine significant numbers, if not all. Is the idea that we want to intercept people before they can actually reach the U.S. Territory, therefore we don't need to put them into the asylum system? Is that the theory, or is that the idea?
Oh, that's definitely a theory that's out there. And the idea, or even the stated mission, as far as the pushing out of the borders, and that's how often officials speak about this, is to intercept people long before they reach U.S. shores. So that's so the idea of stopping people way before they get there, if they, and then in the Haiti case, well, they would be detained in Guantanamo Bay, right, in Cuba, technically. And you can make the same case right now for what's going on on the Mexico's border with Guatemala, where, you know, many, many people from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras are crossing that more and more fortified border, and that border has been fortified, help with plenty of help from the United States, and along this, including doing trainings of Mexican immigration agents, of Mexican police, of Mexican army, sending resources to Mexico for biometrics like digital fingerprinting machines and facial recognition to motion sensors. They have Black Hawk helicopters down there from the United States. And this kind of fortification of the Mexican southern border, which has been happening actually for quite a while, but really, really ramped up in 2014 when Mexico announced what they called a southern border program. And then it's been ramped up even more under this kind of cooperation between the Donald Trump administration and the Andrés Manuel López Obrador administration. So you see this ramping up, the stopping of people long before they get to the U.S. southern border. Many, as we know from Central America, are asylum seekers. So there's a lot of theories out there. Well, this is stopping people who are asking for asylum long before they get to the U.S. borders to be able to do that. And
we should make it clear, when they get to the U.S. border, if they touch U.S. soil, they are then statutorily qualify if they're seeking asylum. They statutorily qualify for some type of adjudication process, right? And
right.
And that's the idea. We were hearing stories that you had custom border officials who were preventing people entering from the southern border to actually go to appropriate border control, border, I guess, like crossings, with the hopes of like preventing them from qualifying for essentially that status that you get when you're seeking asylum.
Right. And that too involves this kind of cooperation that the United States has with Mexico. So Mexico is agreeing, you know, this kind of remain in Mexico program, I guess you call it, that we see on the border right now. And as you say, right, it's the legal process is if people step on U.S. soil, then they have to, you know, then there has to be a credible fear examination and an asylum process initiated. So it does seem like this pushing out of the border, whether it be on the, even on the northern border of with the United States and Mexico, or way in the southern border, or even further, because you can go down to Guatemala, you can go to Honduras, and you see this kind of building up these ripples of borders, or these layers of borders that go further and further to the south. Although you can definitely look at it through the lens of stopping people from getting to the U.S. border for that purpose of asking for asylum.
And it's not just, we're not just doing this in the Western Hemisphere, right? I mean, there is an analogous mechanisms for places that are in no way contiguous with the United States.
That is correct. In the Empire of Borders, I went all over the world. I went to the border between Jordan and Syria, for example, and investigated, you know, millions and millions, $300 million the United States was giving to Jordan to build up its border with Syria and Iraq, and they gave a contract to the Raytheon Corporation. So there's an important point that private companies are often involved in all of this as well. I went to Kenya where Kenya, like Jordan, well, I'm not sure if Jordan, well, Kenya is one of the 23 countries around the world where there's a customs and border protection attaché in the embassy. So that goes to show you like how,
and what is supposed to be happening? Like, what is happening between the Syrian and the Jordanian border that implicates U.S. immigration?
So, there's been a massive amount of immigration coming from Syria. A refugee crisis that. Probably the worst in the world, perhaps. The Jordan really stresses the idea, first of all, of terrorism. So they are really stressing the anti-terrorism, the counter-terrorism. There was an incident in, I believe it was 2014, at one of the ports of entry in Jordan that involved ISIS, I believe, and they pretty much shut down the border from there. But already the United States was really helping Jordan build up its border with Syria. Even though Jordan itself has taken in many, many refugees, about 1.5 million in different camps. But when you talk to I was able to talk to some pretty high up officials who told me what the purpose of the strategy is, and it's Jordan serves as a kind of geopolitical, it's a strategic geopolitical location in the Middle East, as far as maintaining, I guess, what would be a status quo of in a place where, you know, the United States has many interests, as everyone knows, especially with its excursions in Iraq and other places.
So wait a sec. So if I understand you correctly, the calculus is not a national security one, or at least not a direct one, insofar as that we anticipate some of those refugees may be terrorists or people who are, interested in doing us harm or whatever the construction is. It's more that we are invested in halting the flow of various, I guess, immigrants who are political entities entering into a country because it will destabilize a country in some way or destabilize the relationship with the United States that it has with that country?
Yeah, I would like, I guess there's a couple ways to look at it. There's when you look at the Americas and the border and the pushing out of the borders, and you have lots of examples of stopping people before they get to the United States actual border. But when you start going overseas and thinking about situations like Jordan and other places, many other places, then I think it's imperative to start looking at what are U.S. interests in those areas, or what are is there a border around U.S. territory, but is there also a border around U.S. interests? And I think that falls along the lines of what you're saying, like, oh, it's in the U.S. interest that Jordan is not destabilized for whatever reason, right? Or for what reasons that the United States wants its footprint or its foot in the Middle East and that sort of thing.
Our immigration policy is used as a tool. It's at times an end in and of itself, and at other times it seems a means to some other end.
Yeah, you almost have to have there's the strict definition of what immigration control or immigration enforcement would be, but then there's this more loose, almost I would say imperial structure under which it falls, and it can be used in many different ways, including for U.S. interests abroad.
Well, let's talk about that notion, because my sense is your book describes an imperialism that is I guess, I mean, you know, we hear different sort of variants on imperialism, right? Like this is a softer imperialism or it's more surgical or, you know, but give me your sense of how our immigration policy, I mean, so our immigration policy has obviously domestic implications, but it also has these broader international ones. Basically, define and describe for us this notion of border imperialism or imperialism via an extension of almost a malleability of borders, not so much in giving up territory, but in some ways in taking territory.
Right. So the idea of if border imperialism, if you will, when you look around the world in different places, if you follow, you know, U.S. policy, for example, anywhere really around the world, Iraq is a good example for the Middle East, or, you know, the Israel-Palestine as well. But also if you look in Central America, the long processes of U.S. militarism, the economic models that have been shaped, economic policy in places like Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras that really have privileged U.S. corporations going way back to when the United Fruit Company, you know, ruled in Guatemala and Honduras, those sorts of things that have marginalized many, many, many people. And then if people are to, you know, stand up to those sorts of situations, well, then the iron fist comes down. In Central America, the wars of the conflicts of the 1970s and 1980s really show that the dictatorships that were sponsored by the United States, or even, you know, the coups that were instigated by the United States. So one of the things that you see, you know, when you have a policies, you know, throughout the world, that can cause upheavals, that can really marginalize people, that could create a lot of people in dire situations of poverty, or create a lot, you know, help at least impact different situations of violence that people are in. And then there's going to be a certain amount of blowback, or even a lot of blowback, in that sort of world of dramatic inequality, right? When you look at, you know, when to go back to the kind of 1% versus the 99% sort of paradigm, the in order for a status quo where, you know, the wealthy keep getting richer, the poor maintain, you know, their status, to keep a status quo like that intact, well, there has to be a whole kind of system of control. And I think that's where, you know, the kind of analysis or the contextualization of the global border apparatus has to be seen. And then on top of that, you have to look at the ecological situations that are happening, especially as the globe heats up and different places are getting more and more impacted by droughts and sea level rise and extreme weather and that sort of thing that exacerbate situations of, you know, if you're poor and you're in Guatemala and a drought happens and you can't, you know, your crops wilt, then you're screwed. Really, you have to think of something.
I mean, there's obviously like a huge parallel here with the way that some people describe our carceral state, as our police force is basically mopping up the problems created by the inequality and perhaps racism that we have in society that creates a segment of the population that will need to be controlled because they've been exploited and left out of the upside to our society.
Exactly. I think you hit the nail on the head there.
Well,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, please.
Oh, I think that's exactly what this kind of apparatus is doing. And it's important, you know, like to mention that it's not only like the lines of division and halting the movement of people from one place to the other, but if they do that, like if somebody does cross a line of division, then they're illegalized, and then maybe thrown in the carceral state as well, right? They're in prison, they're detained, you know, like the examples of the prison camps that we've been seeing, or the indefinite detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or the forced expulsions of people from one place to the other, or the enforced family separations that all that involves. So yeah, I think that's all, you know, in this this whole, like, to keep the system, the status quo of a system that we have in place intact, that's what's going to happen. That's how you can control it.
Empire of Borders, the expansion of U.S. border around the world. Todd Miller, we'll put a link to your book at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, too.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice was made, the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive,